Therefore let the little people, the sorcerers, the moving picture producers, the space fiction writers, and space comic artists, do the educating and the conditioning. When the time is ripe, then and then only release official information. 9. The governments have a shrewd policy, make the sources as controversial as possible. Encourage, then deny. 49. Blow hot, blow cold, but keep blowing. Stir up argument and controversy. The more the better. It is the best way of educating the people before official announcements can be made. 10. The governments do not know enough about sources yet to make any kind of an official announcement. They are puzzled and doubtful. Therefore they should keep investigating secretly until enough certainty is developed upon which official announcements can be made. 11. It would be bad economic policy to let the people know about flying saucers because the space beings have solved their economic problems, but our world is controlled by moneyed interests which wish to hang on to the status quo here on Earth because it is profitable. 12. Security reasons, mysterious, unsubstantiated, unexplained, but presumably enough said. 13. The governments are secretly hoping that the annoying flying saucers will go away and leave them to their own devices. Comment on collection of reasons. Many people seem to be looking for just one big simple reason to explain all the secrecy. Which of the reasons given is correct, they ask. We doubt if any one reason explains the entire situation. Different nations have different reasons which, to those in authority, naturally seem good and sufficient. We believe that all the reasons given contain at least part of the truth, some of course more than others. Some obviously apply to dictatorships and some to democracies. We have given you a basket full of reasons. Dip in, and help yourself. You may ask, how do I know that these reasons are official? There we have it, that insistence which many people demand for authority outside of themselves. Their own mind, their own ability to think, to reason, to investigate, to know, is never enough. They always depend on others to tell them. Nothing can ever be true unless some outside authority, some government, some university, some professor, some church, some minister or priest says, that is it. All the while they do not see that we are dealing with a subject so new, so out in front, that even eminent authorities cannot give us the answers we would like. We ourselves discovered some time back that if you want the truth about flying saucers, you have to get busy and find it out for yourself. One of our acquaintances stated that he was a U.S. citizen by birth and questioned why the U.S. did not take the world lead in this saucer phenomenon. He did not like the policy of secrecy and wondered why anything had to be hidden. We were amazed that we had actually run into one U.S. citizen with the fortitude to say he did not like the present U.S. policy of secrecy on flying saucers, and suggested that perhaps we should compile a list of reasons as to why the secret policy should be abandoned. A sort of saucer bill of rights for the American citizen should be developed. The following 9 reasons were thus developed with his help as to why the U.S. A. at least should change its policy of saucer secrecy. Reasons against government secrecy. 1. The U.S. government has as yet never even made an adequate public acknowledgement that the flying saucer phenomenon even exists. The entire matter has been left to defense officials whose hostility, evasive tactics and public double talk have branded them as the wrong people to handle so cosmic and transcendental a phenomenon. 2. The whole approach of the U.S. government to this phenomenon is inadequate, and its failure to recognize the interest of the American people in it and their constitutional right to know about it through adequate government action is to be deplored. 3. The little that has been done, instead of being shared with the American people as is their constitutional right, has been on a secretive basis, another indication of a frightening modern tendency toward growing secrecy in our American government. 4. Secrecy in government is abhorrent in our democracy, a violation of the very principles upon which it was founded. Secrecy is creeping into our institutions through defense measures to a point where classified and top secret information is now considered as normal. The insidious effect of this growing secrecy upon our democracy goes on almost unchallenged. 5. It is high time that our government officials, including our military leaders and atom bomb scientists, be reminded that they are still servants of the people. 6. The saucer situation is a reminder to us of this growing tendency on the part of public officials, once they are elected by the people, to immediately look down upon the electorate as ignorant masses who cannot stand the truth about anything. They then set themselves up as self-constituted judges of what the people should or should not be told. 7. The saucer situation is another indication that every year a greater wedge is being driven by these mistaken governmental policies of secrecy between the American people on the one hand and government officials and scientists on the other hand. We are rapidly getting into a frightfully dangerous situation where our population falls into two classes, a small group of know-it-alls who govern and decide everything, and a large mass of people who are kept in ignorance or semi-ignorance of what goes on behind the scenes. This is not democracy, and it is not in keeping with the principles on which this nation was founded. 8. The very psychology of saucer secrecy is wrong. If there is anything that separates a people from a government, it is official secrets. It means the people are no longer a real part of the government. 9. It has been said that U.S. defense officials are afraid the American people will panic if the truth about saucers is released. They remember the Orson Welles affair. What a slur this is on the integrity, stamina and courage of a mighty people. What a false psychology. It is this very policy of secrecy which in itself breeds fear, foreboding and distrust of government in the hearts of the people. We also sat down and endeavored to outline a more constructive governmental program as follows. Constructive program for flying saucer phenomena. 1. Let the U.S.A. acknowledge the saucer phenomena to the American people and to the world. That alone would be a tremendous forward step and a welcome clearing of the atmosphere. 2. Completely reverse the stupid policy of hush-hush, double talk and hot and cold. Get rid of the insidious secrecy and evasion. Give up the idea that public officials are God-appointed judges of what the people should or should not know. Get back to a true psychology, that of mutual confidence and trust between the government and the people. Get back to fundamentals, a government of the people, by the people and for the people. Get back to the idea that government officials are servants of the people, all the way through. Even the gentlemen in the Defense Department and the scientists. 3. Take the handling of the U.S. government saucer program and its infinite cosmic implications out of the hands of the military. They have shown themselves incapable of anything but cheap and ridiculous evasion. It does not belong in their basket. It is far too big for them. Let them retain whatever participation they need for defense. But get the whole program out of the limitations of the Defense Department. 4. In the name of democracy, establish a new U.S. government commission adequately constituted to represent and report to the American people on this terrific phenomenon. Make this commission adequate to take the world leadership in this field. Make the personnel of this commission representative of all groups of people and sympathetic to the phenomenon. Then and then alone will we begin to get results. 5. Here are some of the things a new and adequate U.S. Flying Saucer Commission could do. A. Obtain all the files of the secret investigations and data that have thus far been hidden from the public. In an orderly and non-frightening manner, make a sensible release of this information to the public. Out with it, and never fear the consequences. The American people will welcome it. B. For the first time in history, tell the public the truth about flying saucers, including the truth about any that crashed to Earth, about Hangar 27, Muroc Air Base, and many other things. Report the truth to the people. Publicly encourage people everywhere to report all possible saucer information to this new commission as a public clearinghouse for accurate saucer information. From our own experience, we know that worldwide information would flow to it like a magnet. Report findings to the people. D. Take the restrictions off private and commercial pilots and Air Force personnel, and bring forth their saucer sightings and experiences to the public. E. Encourage universities and astronomical laboratories to develop new equipment to help unravel the mysteries of outer space. Stop the secrecy in these institutions. Also give their saucer photographs and data to the American people. F. Encourage all possible channels of communication and contact with space people, not neglecting telepathy, E.S. P. Extrasensory perception, and other methods. Get the radio hams going full blast, and see what they turn up. Get back to audience participation, that is public participation in this great adventure. Report to the people, G. Give official encouragement to saucer clubs, saucer lectures, and other saucer activities. H. Speed up our efforts to get to the moon first. Give heed to some of the telepathic and ESP messages for needed knowledge on all the factors involved. The conquest of outer space is very important for our future, and the nation that is progressive enough to prove out new sources of cosmic information is the nation that will get the first. What might happen if the American people are not awakened? Would it not be an historic travesty if someday history had to record the incredible fact that America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, had muffed this great cosmic opportunity to lead the world into the knowledge of, and participation in, a community of planets and a magnificent interplanetary civilization? Wake up, American citizens. Wake up. Chapter 9. The Mexican Chauffeur. Salvador Villanueva Medina. The meeting, IT, was 7 p.m. on January 7, 1955. We were gathered together in the old Colonia San Pedro section of Mexico City at Call Cinco No. 10. We included an audience of over 200 Mexicans and friends, gathered in expectation of hearing a lecture on flying saucers. The lecturer, my husband Bryant, was sitting on the platform with a blackboard behind him which he had requested. Señor G.B., the newspaper editor, had sponsored the meeting, and there were a number of distinguished guests present. It was a gala occasion, the first effort in Mexico City toward the formation of a flying saucer organization. Señor G.B. started the meeting by introducing a series of guests who told of interesting saucer sightings in and around Mexico City. He then introduced Bryant, who got his lecture off to a good start by stating phrases in English, which would then instantly be translated into Spanish by an excellent interpreter. Then would follow another phrase of English and another lightning-like translation. It was going nicely, and the audience was listening in rapt attention. After certain presentations, Bryant came to a pause, and with everyone thus alerted, he asked the audience rather dramatically, "Has anyone present ever seen a spaceman? Please raise your hands." Now I knew that Bryant intended this merely as a sort of rhetorical question and that he expected to go on and say something like, "Well, just look at your neighbor, we are all space people, we live on a spaceship ourselves called the Earth." Then he would develop the theme that the Earth itself is a type of spaceship. 56. One of the Mexican newspapers reported the incident the next day, stating that, "Shocked silence, absolute silence, followed this part of the lecture." It surely did, and Bryant seemed to be enjoying the effect. The pause was quite long. He was just about to continue when, believe it or not, a man way in the back row near the door got to his feet and raised his hand. Bryant was petrified, frozen. His face registered a mixture of shocked surprise, incredulity, watodo, and the idea that anything could happen in Mexico. The audience saw the raised hand and the meeting immediately broke into a veritable bedlam. Bryant looked at Señor G.B., who shook his head in bewilderment. They conferred and decided it was dangerous to let the man speak, as his claim of seeing a spaceman might be just a hoax. It was quite a difficult situation. By that time, however, members of the audience were standing on chairs, shouting demands that the man be heard. The man was pushed forward to the platform, and Señor G.B. gave him a seat and motioned to Bryant to continue the lecture. Bryant tried, but it was impossible, for the clamor for the other man to speak was irresistible. Finally, Señor G.B. did the only thing possible under the circumstances to quiet the audience. He permitted this Earthman who had stated he had seen a spaceman to speak to the audience. That, my friends, was our unconventional and exciting introduction to a remarkable Mexican who was later to be known to many as the Mexican Adamski. He was a chauffeur named Salvador Villanueva Medina, and he told an amazing story of sitting up most of one night with two men from outer space in a broken-down automobile some 300 miles north of Mexico City on the Laredo Road in August of 1953. We could see that his AC count made a deep impression on the audience. It was all in Spanish, and our interpreter was so interested himself that he did not give much of it to us in English. Finally, the man finished and was roundly applauded. Bryant closed the lecture, the high point, however, being the account given by the Mexican chauffeur. We decide to investigate. Salvador Villanueva Medina's experience caused quite a sensation among those interested in sources. Many Mexicans had been complaining that the Space Brothers seemed to be landing everywhere but in Mexico. Here was much more than a saucer sighting. Here was an actual contact with space people right in Mexico. It is one thing to discuss contacts in far-off countries, but it is another to find that people in your own community are having such experiences right at home. Here was Mexico's opportunity for its own Adamski. But, of course, the experience had to be investigated and checked. There were, as always, plenty of skeptics. Many people were asking a very pertinent question: why did the chauffeur keep this terrific experience to himself for almost 17 months? Why had he not told about it before? His reply to this was that he had told certain people about it right after it occurred and had been completely rebuffed. He told his wife, and they agreed that for the sake of his job it was necessary to keep it quiet. The story intrigued us so much that we had many sessions with Senor GB and the chauffeur, at which we discussed his experience thoroughly. A written transcript of his story was made in great detail. We became well acquainted with him and at his request called him Salvador. We trust he will not mind if we call him by that name in this account of our experiences together. We longed to know the truth ourselves and all the minute incidents connected with this contact, and so did Senor GB. We all realized there were no witnesses, but we had slowly learned that only a few people contacted in recent times in all the world had any witnesses. Any researcher has to recognize this situation. Please remember, we have been private saucer investigators, nothing more. There has never been anything official whatsoever in our investigations. Our policy in such matters has been to live with the people having the saucer experiences so that we could get the feel of them ourselves and make up our own minds. Convincing others has never been our goal. We wanted to convince ourselves one way or another. We were just as desirous of disproving this contact as we were of proving it. We discussed with Senor GB the possibility of his getting the chauffeur off from work for 3 or 4 days and our driving to the town of Valls, near which the encounter took place, in order to make a careful investigation. He thought this was a good idea and it was eventually arranged. Meanwhile, we did everything possible to find out what we could about Salvador and his background and to get the account of his contact written down. Salvador himself is a fairly young Mexican of humble status. He is short, stocky and has dark black hair. He has not been blessed with much schooling or education. He is married and has a fine family of 7 children, whom he supports by his work as a chauffeur and taxi driver. Personally, we found him very likable and discovered that he had a good sense of humor. His face shows character and one can fairly feel his honesty and sincerity. His humility made an impression upon us, no boastfulness or bombast at all, but rather a "why was I worthy of it" attitude. One outstanding characteristic is his excellent photographic memory, together with really exceptional powers of observation, down to minute details. He is a very religious and pious soul and does not drink any intoxicants. We became friends. His remarkable experience in condensed form is hereby presented just as we obtained it from him, but translated rather freely into English. Mexican chauffeur's account of his contact with spaceman. 59. On the 20th of August, 1953, about 9 p.m. I was covering my taxi route, in Mexico City, in which work I have been engaged since 1931. I picked up as passengers two Texans, a man and his wife. He was approximately 50 years old, had grayish hair, was slender and tall. She was a little shorter than he and seemed about 40 years of age. I picked them up in the Zocalo to take them to the Oxford Hotel. During the ride he asked me to recommend a chauffeur to drive their automobile to Laredo, which was then in a repair shop undergoing a checkup following an AC incident. As I was interested in such work, I returned to see them the following day at 10 a.m. We picked up their automobile, which was a 1952 Buick. The rest of the day I drove them to various places. They paid me and then hired me to drive them to Laredo starting at 9 a.m. the following day. The next day after they had done some shopping we started for Laredo driving at a speed of 60 to 70 miles per hour. Beyond valves the gearbox, differential, divlap trouble, and we had to stop on the side of the road. It was late afternoon. The North Americans decided to go back to town and get a mechanic. They hailed a passing car and told me to wait and watch their car. I decided to raise the car with a jack as I wanted to see if I could fix it before my clients returned. It was beginning to get dark. Only two or three cars passed. I was very solitary. All of a sudden I heard someone coming near me. I could hear footsteps. I looked out from underneath the car and I saw two legs in front of me. The legs were covered with trousers of a material like corduroy. I felt fear and got out from under the car. A man with a very white face was before me. He was dressed in a one-piece garment of a corduroy-like material which covered even his feet. It was tight at the ankles, cuffs and neck, but was loose elsewhere, giving the appearance of being elastic. Around his waist he wore a thick belt, about 3 inches wide of a bluish color. The strange thing about the belt was that it had holes in it, and the holes would light up little by little as if they had electric lights inside. Under his arm was a helmet, like those used by football players, but from the earpieces ran fine wires. He had fine features and a penetrating look. No beard. His hair was fine, wavy, gray and reached his shoulders. He seemed about 4 feet tall and to weigh about 110 pounds. I was afraid and was trembling inside. He asked me twice in correct Spanish what was wrong with my car. I could not answer because I was frightened and was watching him closely. "Can't you talk?" the stranger then asked. "Yes," I finally responded, and the only thing I could think to say was, "Are you an aviator?" "Yes," he replied. "My machine, which you people call an airplane, is there," and he pointed in the direction of a little mound in front of us. "You are not from Mexico?" I then asked. "No," he said, "I come from a place at much space." Literal translation. The word space caught my attention, but it never occurred to me then to think of other planets but only of other countries. I invited him to get into the car as it was almost dark, but his belt began to send out luminous flashes and I noticed a buzzing sound coming from it. He put on his helmet, raised his arm in a parting gesture, and walked away toward the hill, leaving me alone. At about 200 meters I could still see his belt lights twinkling like fireflies. I stood next to the car watching until he was out of sight. I removed the jack from underneath the car. Two motorcycle officers came by and made me move the car off the road. Then I got inside the car and tried to sleep. Occasional cars would come by and wake me up. Later I was aroused by some strong knocks on the car window. I saw two people standing near the car and thought they were the owners of the automobile. My surprise was great when I saw it was my aviator friend, but this time he was accompanied by another taller person but with the same kind of uniform. Without thinking I asked them to come into the car, which they did. The small one sat next to me, then the taller one. I turned my back toward the door so as to observe them every time a car passed by. Then it occurred to me to turn on the dome light. I did so and could see the interest with which the taller of them was observing me. His skin was also very white. A nervous trembling started to invade me. "Are you Europeans?" I finally dared ask. The smaller one answered that they came from another place far more distant. "Our place," he said, "is much more inhabited than this. The you do not find much room between people and people." Then he began to talk quite freely, but the taller one limited himself to nodding his head in acknowledgement. The smaller one told that in his place the towns covered everything. There were no uninhabited areas, and the streets were continuous. The people did not walk on the streets because they were metallic, and from them their vehicles took their power. There was a great quantity of vehicles of great diversity, but they never used any kind of fuel. Streets never crossed at the same level. Some had sidewalks made of endless bands, belts, running in opposite directions. I asked about vegetables, fruits and cereals such as we eat. He answered that all the houses had little patios in the center where there was a garden and a well. They produced all the food they needed, everything and much more than we on Earth eat was produced in these interior patios. He added that they did not have big trees. They did not have tall buildings. In a street block they had continuous buildings. 62. I asked if they had any oceans or seas. He said yes and that everything was inhabited. I asked him if they had no fuels, how was power generated? He told me that energy was generated in productive centers which took advantage of inexhaustible solar rays. The conversation went on for hours. Sometimes I felt they were joking. Being a man without much schooling, I had never heard of anything like this before. I tried to figure out what country they were from. Finally, with hesitation, I asked where their country was because everything seemed so fantastic. They both laughed, but not at all in an offensive manner. Then the smaller one said, "We are talking about another world as you call this one on which you live." In spite of his harmonious voice, I was again getting uneasy, but I finally asked them how they traveled from their world. The short one answered that soon I would have the opportunity to see the ship in which they traveled. After telling me this, they both observed me intently. The short man patted my right leg and said, "Does this surprise you?" "Well, it will surprise you far more to know that in this world you live on there are men like us amongst you who live, dress and eat like you do. And it is they who report to us all the data about your wars, your progress, your ways of living and your government." I could not believe what they were saying and said in a mocking way, "Well, what form of life and government have you?" He replied, "The stage that you are passing through now, we lived thousands of years ago. Our world also suffered many wars and destructive retrogressions as well as Prigger's sons. Finally an agreement was reached between the different governments so that what you call nations and countries disappeared and we all became sons of the same world. A council of wise men was formed, and they are the ones who now govern. Those who have exceptional minds or are outstanding in any realm of knowledge belong to this group. The headquarters of this government is in a central place. In each group or nucleus there is a representative of this council who is in charge of receiving and studying the suggestions of the inhabitants and of transmitting agreements. All of these men are very capable and wise. Among the lower classes there is no extreme poverty as each inhabitant willingly works where he is sent or placed and has enough to live well. No one takes orders with them. Their children. From the time they are small they go to a certain zone where they are duly attended to. There they live and grow up and are educated according to their physical and mental qualities. Later they live in the nucleus to which they are assigned." As dawn appeared the visitors got out of the car. A buzzing noise came either from their helmets or their belts. I summoned courage to ask them where the noise came from and both of them indicated their belts. The small man told me that the belts could also be used to check an NMI. They started off the road to the right, east, across the fields, and I followed them. The ground was covered by trees and brush. Finally we came to the ship which was roughly 10 meters in diameter and possibly half as high. At a signal a section of the ship opened and I could see certain things in the interior. My visitors invited me inside. At this I became utterly panic-stricken and turned and ran back to the highway and the car. A few minutes later, standing beside the car and gazing in the direction of the ship, I saw it rise slowly above the treetops. It was oscillating and was luminous with bluish rays around it. Then it took off and quickly disappeared in the direction of the rising sun. Towards noon, the North Americans returned along with a mechanic who diagnosed the car trouble as damage due to lack of lubricant in the gearbox.